My name is Kathleen Hurdy, and the title of this session is Sharing Power, the Art of Collaboration. And since we're a small group tonight, I am going to propose that each of us introduce ourselves so we'll know who we're talking with. I come from New York City. I'm director for Ecumenical Networks in the National Council of Churches and come out of a background of public education and family collaboration.
I'm Harold Schnarig from Edmonds, Washington, and visiting the second time, so I try to catch the topics that I think might interest me, and I'm volunteering time, so I have to catch what I can. So that makes it doubly important that I chose this one.
Great, I should say so. Thank you.
I'm Ruth Siebert, and I'm from Los Angeles, and I work with Lutheran Social Services, and also with Good Samaritan Counseling Center. And it's an issue that has certainly been of interest to me for a long time. I remember getting into conversations with Kathleen Brady about this 19 years ago.
Right.
And I'm Dave Hurdy, and I'm Director of House Operations and House Chaplain at Seafarers International House in New York City. And I'm an ELCA pastor, and I'm married to Kathleen, and we have collaborated for 39 years plus, actually.
Coming up on 40, huh?
We were engaged for what?
5 years before that.
We had gone together, so we've had a long-standing collaboration.
Well, it's my view that collaboration and collaborative leadership depends heavily on the assumptions people make about power. And sharing power, I think, can be both a challenge and an opportunity, or even a delight in some cases. But it requires really essential tools and intentional tools to make it work. I spent this afternoon interviewing the directors of Holden Village. We have here such a marvelous illustration of collaborative leadership. And I was interested in finding out what made it work, where were the challenges, and how conflicts were resolved, and all of those things that have to do with the kind of collaborative leadership that is expected in any kind of a team leadership situation. Tonight we're going to be talking about collaborative leadership, though more, a little bit more generically, applicable to congregations, to certainly school classrooms, to any kind of organizational setting, including committee work and other sorts of ways in which we organize ourselves to get together.
Families,
of course, exactly. So collaboration with a basis in shared power, or the idea of sharing power, is an important thing. But let's back up a little bit and talk about this whole concept of power. Particularly for women, power has been something women have often said they don't have. No, that's fine. Feel free to break in, because I think that makes
sense. Women have said that. Yet the woman, I think, is stronger biologically than the man. She lives longer. Or is that the reason that they end up with all of the... Okay, Ma Bell is called that because it's owned by the spinsters, old ladies, the women of America. And there are other ways that I think women have power. They just don't realize what power they have. Right.
Well, I think, Ben, part of that is because the socio-cultural definitions we've given to power have pretty much come out of a more patriarchal model. Now, patriarchy can be said to be that way of being in the world, which is normed predominantly on men's experience. But women have participated in patriarchy too. And certainly patriarchal forms of power are not the only forms of power that have existed in the world and that continue to exist in the world. But in terms of the cultural milieu in which women, particularly now if we think of women in the United States, in our sociocultural history, women have tended to be associated with the private and men with the public world. That's changing. It's changing quite radically and in this century, and it hasn't always followed that that was the case. We have been celebrating the 75th anniversary of the vote for women at this point in time, this week actually, August 26th, 2 days ago, was the anniversary of the women getting the vote in the U.S. And that took a lot of public action on the part of women too. But the old public-private slip, the old public-private split, has taken much more time to go away, I think. Let's look for a moment at what it is that, and your comment stimulates this, women have more power than they think they do. Let's think about what power is. If you were to define power, if you were to think of the first word that comes to your mind in terms of power, what word would you choose?
Decision would be a word.
Decisions?
Came through.
All right. Decisions certainly may have to be made, and how does that relate to power?
Well, who makes the decisions?
Who makes decisions? Decisions, who makes them? Key. A key concept within power is how decision-making
happens. Especially in leadership concepts, because, I mean...
What?
Especially in a matter of leadership, I
right.
think that... You know, who is it that makes the decisions? I mean, and traditionally or historically, I suppose you'd say, decisions have been sort of made by somebody who's supposedly on top.
Okay, all right.
That's kind of a hierarchical.
So the people who have power to make decisions, traditionally you say, have been on top. Okay.
Okay. So, but yeah, so that kind of breaks down into things like, who can say no and make it stick, or who can suggest things and they work out. I'm struggling with this because I'm expecting you to come up with some.
Oh, I will too.
I think power is the ability to affect change.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, that's kind of what you were suggesting.
Right.
You know, the person who can say, say, let's do it and cause it to happen.
Uh-huh. Okay. The ability to make change, the ability to get things done, as some people say, is a good definition of power. In another format, if you think of ways in which you have been in a situation where there seemed to be a power imbalance, where did the imbalance come from? Ruth, you and I had a conversation at dinner that made me think of a word.
Conflict.
Conflict, all right. Power involves conflict often when there is an imbalance of power. Or when power becomes extremely controlling. So people often think of power as control. And in organizations today, if you think of the people that are assumed to have a considerable amount of power, they are people who control what?
Money.
What else?
Resources,
other resources.
And control people also, being able to, by even intimidation, sometimes.
Right.
You know,
okay,
I mean,
so organizational forms of power, control is perceived often as control over people, money, and resources. That's not the only use of power, clearly. There's also decisional power, and there's change power, power to get things done. Those are other aspects of power.
Another one is the attitudes or thoughts or ideas or the more mental things that go into pulling these guys together.
Right. Over here, you mean?
Yeah.
Ideas. The power of an idea.
The power of ideas is an important element of power, and that people who have the imagination, who have the creativity, who have the ability.
Power of persuasion, too.
Right.
Persuasion.
Right.
Some people can persuade you to do things that you might not otherwise have done.
That's true.
Yeah.
I know.
Power is often given to not necessarily the people who have the ideas, but to the one who people think should be in power over.
Perceived positions, I think.
All right, so you're talking
about
the power of position and the power that person is perceived to have be the powerful person in that position, okay?
I think often in organizational structure that we have a tendency to have a kind of a preconceived notion about an organization, mm-hmm. that there are certain positions in that organization that have more power than others.
Right,
but
right.
That may be the result of a history of struggle to get that reputation.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about this history of struggle, because let's say the struggle was around an idea. And the person has had an idea and has had to struggle to get heard in an organization. Finally, let's say that person gets a hearing. Then you're saying that person then has more power because their idea has been accepted by others or in collaboration with others.
Well, my concept was if they carry out that idea, then later there's another problem. This person has to then come up with a strategy and carry through the same pattern of making his strategy become that of the organization.
Right, okay, so the ideas have to keep generating, keep growing, in order for those ideas to become more and more powerful in terms of problem solving in the organization. Certainly problem solving is one aspect of power that's crucial. Now,
what about issues of authority? I think about when I was a young parish pastor and how, but people have given me authority by virtue of my age, it seems, in some situations,
mm-hmm.
that they simply did not give me when I was a young parish pastor.
Right.
And that's the position or...
Or they did not give me when I was working with a man.
Yeah.
He got the authority.
Right. All right, so authority has to do with position.
Right.
It can have to do with position. It can have to do with ideas, too. The vision, the person who has the authority of a clear and well-articulated vision, especially one drawn from the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also, but before we go on, let's also look at the fact that the position itself may be an authority position. Pastors and congregations have a certain authority simply by being holding the role or the position or the call of pastor. So positions can offer authority as well as ideas.
Well, what I was going to say was some of this is culturally conditioned too.
Yeah,
there's
right.
a cultural conditioning that has taken place in certain societies. Probably in our society, we've taken over the model in many ways of the Roman army. You know, that's been one model that has affected Western civilization
right.
tremendously mm-hmm. in terms of style of organizational structure, a kind of a line of command. Uh-huh. And you still hear that. You hear this.
Whether, chain of command.
Chain of command, whether or not. And, you know, that's what the United States, the Army, this young woman that left the, this, what do you call
Citadel.
It? Citadel, yeah. You know, I mean, that's what was really at stake there, you know, was that they think a woman can't be a part of that line of command's thinking. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Really, I mean, that's really what was at stake there.
Oh, yeah.
The, another, or one of the traditionally classical definitions of power used by Emerson in his work on organizational theory is the ability to get other people to do what they would not otherwise do. A kind of a forcing of the direction in power.
Or leading of direction or whatever.
Right. Well, you could say forcing or you could say leading.
It could be coercion or it could be...
It could be coercion or it could be persuasion. Yeah. And it could be power to coerce. So there's coercive power. And power to persuade, there's persuasive power, and power to model, which is another form of leadership, to model as leader, power to, in a sense, to lead, because this means it has still different meanings. So the ability to get others to do what perhaps it is to do what the mission of the organization is also a legitimate a form of power. The ability to get things done is another less unidirectional, more mutual form of power, though it too can be illegitimately or legitimately used. Well, let's move on to see what organizations might look like that. Well, here's a bigger cloth that are based on some of these understandings of power. What collaboration might look like based on these varying understandings of power. These are what we've been talking about, are sort of conceptual notions about power that are common today. If we were to put a long line across the board here and put collaboration on one end, and control on the other, various definitions of power fit along that continuum. And I.A. Richards, the great rhetorician, has long argued for understanding concepts, all of concepts, in terms of a range of meanings. So often we tend to narrow the meanings of a concept. And my own struggle around the issues of power has been because I saw power in too narrow a meaning. And so my interest has been in expanding the range of meanings. What are some of the traits that you would think of people who model power? Think of people you know who model the power of control or the power of collaboration. What kind of traits do you expect from those people? Or think of your own way of working. What does it take to use collaborative power?
Flexibility.
Pardon me?
Flexibility.
All right, it takes flexibility. People who are collaborative have to have a certain amount of give and take. People who tend to use more, or to put more stress on controlling power, are usually not very flexible.
Well,
people.
Demanding.
All right, control involves demanding, demands.
Or structure or rigidity here.
Controlling people often, I think, withhold information.
Okay.
That has been my experience of Chris and I are working for right now.
They give limited.
Limited information.
To
keep me from being able to make a decision or move forward. So
And communication becomes a very major part. We'll talk about that a little later. A very major part of collaboration as well. What other traits would you expect in a collaborative use of power?
Trust.
Heavy emphasis on trust.
Honesty.
Willingness to share.
Ego strength.
Pardon?
Ego strength.
Now, does that work at the other end?
Lack of ego strength.
Right.
I think there's a lot of that in control.
Okay. All right.
And in the ego strength, too, I would...
Describe a little more what you mean by ego strength.
What I mean by ego strength is that I am not threatened by your power.
Right.
That I'm not threatened by your gifts and what you have to offer. That I recognize that what I have to offer is of value. And that what we offer, what we work together to offer is of more value. As a result of that.
So that gets
strong
into
self-image.
Self-concept. It involves
some strong words,
emotional health.
No.
So to use the power of collaboration, these would be required. You're defining ego strength in terms of these characteristics. A lack of ego strength would mean a singular ego, where ego became privatized rather than shared.
Right, and then I have to protect that, and then somehow...
Insecure.
If you have power, that takes away power from
right.
me.
Right, okay, so power then, in this respect, is a shareable resource.
Right.
Or distributed, or...
Pardon?
Or distributed.
A distributable resource.
Right.
It's not limited. It's not
right.
a limited
And
resource.
Here, power would be a finite resource or a held closely resource.
Right.
I think finite is important.
Concentrated,
held tightly together, kept in tow. More than shared. What are some of the other marks of this kind of controlling power? We've experienced them. We've seen them.
They micromanage.
Boards that micromanage, or CEOs that micromanage.
Yeah.
Let's just say. And that. Micromanagement can be a dangerous thing in terms of building the strengths of the people in the organization itself, because the tendency is to do it for them rather than nurture the growth that comes
or miss the creativity that comes through
right.
sharing and
yeah.
the dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think micromanagers miss the big picture, and that they're supposed to have to help, and they lose vision.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then if we're going to not micromanage and we're going to have a more collaborative idea of leading an organization, then what you're saying is that vision is required, the big picture.
Yes, and I think shared vision is required.
Okay, and tell me a little bit more about how you see shared vision.
I think my experience is when creative people, come up with, one person might come up with an idea, but the vision gets developed by, the people who are collaborating on leadership. So it becomes something owned by you know, for example, if you're talking about the three directors here,
right.
It would become owned by those
by
directors.
All three.
Right, by all three.
All
and it would be and it would be something which ultimately you could not track back to one person.
Okay, so a shared vision is a vision that represents more of a holistic view.
Right.
But there has to be more than just the leader involved in that then.
Right. Then you and the ability then to bring others on board with your vision.
Okay. There's a lot of work being done these days in the field of organization theory on the and organizational leadership on the whole notion of strategic positioning, which is dreaming together, strategic positioning, dreaming together about where you'd like to see your organization, your congregation, your family in say the year 2000 and the year in the next century. What are the strengths that you bring as an organization together? That requires leaders not only developing their own shared vision and having a big picture, but doing a good deal of listening to what the people in the organization bring to that. I go back to your idea of ideas that need to be shared as power grows and develops in an organization, that you begin to collect as a leader the good ideas that come from the people who are committed to working in the organization or sharing in the congregation.
And would it also not, would, in that thinking, would the particular gifts, particular strengths of members of a staff or whatever, would that be also contribute to the strategic positioning?
Oh yes, definitely.
You
because
would, you
right.
would decide, oh well, we have this resource here and this need, let's develop in this direction.
Right. And it may be being then those individual staff members being able to say, these are the gifts I bring to the table.
Right.
I don't have these gifts, I don't have those gifts, but these are the gifts I bring, and I can use those in the development of leadership for this particular possibility.
Right.
Okay, so we're just to review. Hi,
hi.
And welcome. We're talking about the fact that, or the belief that the assumptions we make about power determine the quality of the collaboration that we do as we develop collaborative power within organizations, within families, within congregations, and so on. And we've been talking about the whole range of meanings in power. The more power is control or is a finite resource, meaning if you have more, I have less, or power as a shareable resource and as seen in collaboration, that power is something that can grow and develop as organizations or people work together in nurturing that growth and nurturing each other's ideas and building on each other's strengths. It's not that this kind of power would never be used, but it tends to lead toward domination. And that's been one of the key challenges. Domination has been one of the key challenges to the kind of pyramidal structure of organizations where power resides in a controlling way, often at the top, and information is often withheld or moves predominantly in a downward progression in the pyramidal style of organization. One has to be careful because I know that it's easy to oversimplify these organizations, structures. But the pyramid is based on the assumption that power resides at the top. Other models for power that have been building more on this whole idea of collaborative power are models like the web and like the double helix. And this is not a particular drawing of the double helix. Double helix is a part of the DNA molecule structure, and I'm using that more or less a Möbius strip to show something similar. But the idea of the double helix is the chiral and intertwined cords that go down the center, and they move back and forth. So the double helix model is being developed as a form of administrative or as a model for administration by a woman by the name of Helen Reagan, who teaches at in New London, Connecticut. I believe it's the University of Connecticut College or University of Connecticut. I'd have to go back and check. Helen Reagan is developing an administrative model based on the double helix idea. Early thinkers on the web kind of thinking are Carol Gilligan, whose work was very instructive. She really wrote in the 70s, and I came in touch with her work when I was doing graduate work at UC Berkeley. And she writes from the point of view of a psychology, and she had been working with Leonard Kohlberg, on ideas of moral development, and was teaching his material for a number of years until she discovered that he had normed his stages of moral development totally on boys. His conversation was with little boys, and he had made the question, that posed the moral dilemma, the famous moral dilemma about Hans and his wife. Hans's wife was very ill. They were very poor. Should he steal medicine when he didn't have money to pay for it so that his wife could live? And he posed that question to little boys, and they had over the period of time of his research, he discovered a whole set of moral development understandings that grew out of their responses to this story. And most of it was based on what Carol Gilligan later comes to call the ethic of justice. Gilligan said that these answers were very legitimate answers. The boys would say, yes, of course he should steal it, because the greater good, the greater justice was that his wife lived. And the little girls would say, well, when she started asking the question to girls, they would say, well, I'm not so sure. If he steals the medicine, he may get into trouble, may get put in jail, then he wouldn't be there to care for his wife. And, well, couldn't he do some other kinds of something else? Couldn't he persuade someone else to buy it for him? Or couldn't he think of another alternative? The little girls tended to work more on what Gilligan came to call an ethic of care, as not to opposing an ethic of justice, but just adding a dimension to the full understanding of an ethical dilemma. Well, Carol Gilligan went on to develop some contrast between web and pyramid based on her research in moral development, and believed that the web, where the leaders were in the center of the organization, keeping in touch with, linked to, connected to all parts of the organization, and that there was mutual flow of information all directions, that instead of withholding information, information was shared like a spider web throughout the organization. Instead of giving demands, there were invitations into the center, recalling people to the vision of the organization. So there are various ways in which these kinds of models are beginning to replace, or at least become a viable alternative to, the pyramid model. Another person who has done a great deal of work is a woman by the name of Sally Helgeson, who's not an academic researcher, but a journalist who has written on told some of the stories of leadership where the web style of leadership works best. She has also said that this style of work, and going back, Dave, to your comment on the Roman army model, this style of leadership represents a warrior model. And she contrasts the warrior and the web as two different ways of leading that are take account of two different understandings of power. Sally Helgeson tells about the work of a number of people in leadership, but one of the people that she talks about and describes is a woman by the name of Frances Hesselbein, who was the director of the Girl Scouts, and she developed a shared leadership model that not in terms of the executive position, but in terms of the whole organization, that was very effective. Frances Hesselbein is now working with Peter Drucker, who has been one of the key organizational leadership writers over the last 20 years or so. And both Peter Drucker and Tom Peters, whose book In Search of Excellence is also very popular, have said it's time we looked at women's ways of leadership to learn something new about leadership for the next century. So that's, are there comments or questions at this point? Does that make sense? Welcome in to the discussion.
I left, I retired, and they were talking about an open office concept where the only person, or the manager sat in the middle and there were no walls for the other desks. I can't remember offhand now if the manager has a private office or not, but he's in the middle of this. I think the concept was there had to be eye contact. And then they talk about team leader. Well, they haven't changed their terminology yet, really, to get to the concept of team leader, but they used...
But they were moving in that direction.
The rule was nobody could get a separate office if you were a worker, but if you were a manager, you might get one.
So the philosophy, and that was that a business or a corporation?
That was Blue Cross.
Blue Cross.
The direction they were going, and who knows, it takes a long to get there.
So yeah. Well,
it'll change before they get there.
But it already has, hasn't it?
Probably. Yeah. But that would seem to fit the web.
Right. And the idea of eye contact, or people being in constant communication with each other, as essential to the health of the organization, is much more a webbed way of working. So the information becomes, information sharing becomes a value instead of withholding information.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now,
one of the misconceptions, though, I think, you know, you can look at this and say, well, this takes a lot of time to work this out, to have all this kind of webbing back and forth and intercommunication, and it slows the process of getting something done down. I mean, slows it down.
Right.
Whereas I wonder sometimes, though, if the top down, when you get someone on top who's giving a job, assigning things to others, if the job gets done any quicker.
No.
Everything revolves around them focusing on it sometimes. And so that other people underneath in that pyramid can get it done faster sometimes if, you know.
If they don't have the down.
That person's withholding action or whatever.
Right. There's Helen Reagan, who is working on the double helix model, has said that below the fault line, she uses this dotted line, here's the fault line. Below the fault line, there's a lot of wisdom and a lot of energy that's often not tapped because the information flow is downward instead of mutual information sharing all of the time. Other comments or questions?
I think that...
Okay, in a family, you got two people. Where do we stand there?
Well, we may have to draw a different kind of a model. Or...
But if you have children, you don't have two.
Yeah, that's true.
That's right, you don't.
That's true, yeah. So it has to be expandable.
Right. And I think part of the question of that comes up, and it comes up in family systems theory as well as just families as they work, is the question of how do you share power when there are older and younger people, people with more skill, more strength, more often, I mean, these days kids are getting to be quite remarkable, and often they have wisdom beyond their years. How then do you account for those differences in age and experience that often make it impossible for families to communicate with each other?
Okay, say it once more.
Wasn't a real clear question.
How do you account for the differences?
How do you deal with, or deal, maybe deal with is a better word, how do you deal with when there are differences of age, size, experience? Little people often feel left out of the decision making, or feel powerless about having a say. What makes families work better than the power pyramid model? Because in that case, the parents are usually at the top of the pyramid and the kids are way down at the bottom.
Well, usually there is some kind of consensus between the parents, and then within that, the consensus is that the child is going to go to school, but the child is allowed to choose maybe which dress. That's a common one. That's one my wife used at preschool. You give the kid a decision to make, and who knows, it may be an important decision about what to wear. Maybe it is. Mm-hmm. Although there's other examples of that. To involve.
Right.
Involve
them in the and give them the information on issues that are age appropriate.
Yeah.
But
right.
One of the issues I think that has happened is that too many children have been given information that they have no business having, and it burdens them terribly.
Yeah.
You know, they get, the parent crosses that boundary and tries to make the child an adult.
Involves
decisions that,
well,
that the parents have to need, you know, have the responsibility to be making.
Well, easily the whole idea of giving children choices early on, so that the practice of decision making starts early in ways that are age appropriate, is one, and then nurturing them to make more and more difficult decisions as they go along. One of the terms that's used is nurtured growth. In terms of I have been working on a model of shared power, focusing on the whole idea of connectedness or coactive empowerment. And in my research at Berkeley, where I did my doctorate, I was looking at the ways in which women in the principalship empowered active educational growth in their schools in collaboration with parents, teachers, faculty, staff, and others. And I found in my research with women principals that one of the things they did was a lot of nurturing of growth, whether it was nurturing the growth of teachers in becoming more participatory in the faculty meeting and making decisions together, whether it was nurturing growth among the kids or whatever. So nurtured growth was certainly one form of power that fit on effective leadership style of women principals. Another aspect that women used frequently that was often in a patriarchal model not considered power was the use of emotional energy. Both anger and love both passion and persuasion, but a lot of emotional energy went into their work as principals. In a patriarchal model, built bureaucracies are often built on a more pyramidal style of organization, and rationality is the key, not emotionality. Overuse of emotions, obviously, like overuse of reason, can be detrimental. But the women principals that I interviewed for my research used a great deal of emotional energy, caring a lot about the kids that were in the school. Many of these were in large urban schools where the difficulties that kids faced were enormous, and their ability to take personal caring concern for both the teachers, the parents, and the kids was quite remarkable. Another strength that they, or form of power that they used, was reciprocal talk. They did a lot of talking together. It was kind of that eye contact idea. They spent a lot of time talking directly with parents, talking directly with kids, with faculty or teaching staff. But when they talked in a manner that was reciprocal. You and I have had experiences where we're talked past, where we say something and the next person says something to us that totally discounts what we have just said. Doesn't mean they have to agree with it, but they don't take it into account. So it's like you're having a conversation over here and a conversation over there. Reciprocal talk is paying attention to the ideas of another, making sure that those ideas are part of the grist for the mill. In addition to reciprocal talk, they did a lot of chewing the cud. I call it pondered mutuality. They would bring a decision, the principals would bring a decision.
You mean chewing the fat?
Yeah, no, chewing the cud. Yeah, chewing the fat too, I suppose, the mutuality. They would come to the faculty meeting with a difficult decision that had to be made, whatever that decision was. And they'd lay out the problem on the table. The teachers would often be aware of the problem already and would contribute to the possibility of a solution. And then they'd the principal would say, well, let's sit on this for a while. Let's chew on this for a while. Go home, take some time, reflective time, thinking through what that decision ought to be, taking into account the ideas of the other, perhaps checking with parents, perhaps weighing the issue in their mind. So before decisions were made, there was a lot of pondered mutuality, keeping in mind what the other person's ideas were. And then the last piece that I came across, and this is very common sense, it almost doesn't sound it doesn't sound like anything new. In fact, a lot of this isn't new. What's new about it is that it's just now included in an understanding of power.
It's now being valued.
What?
It's now being valued.
It was valued by these particular principals. When I did my research at Berkeley, I was angry and frustrated by the way in which I was being taught administration, which was in the pyramidal model. And I began to decide that, along with a number of other of my classmates, that there were other ways to administer. And when I went to interview women principals who were effective, I was just curious if women use and talk about power in a different way. When I came to the interviews, I would say, how do you resolve conflict? How do you get decisions made? How do you make change happen? How do you get things done that need to be done? All of the questions I could think about that a good administrator would have to deal with. I took copious notes in how they did that. And then I came to a section called power, and I said, how do I'm gonna ask you some questions about power. And almost unanimously they said, and these were individual interviews over time, but they said, most of them said, well, this will be short because I don't have any power. Back to your earlier point, that women did not perceive themselves in a hierarchical school district of having power. They were middle managers caught between the demands of the headquarters and the demands of the parent community and teaching community and so forth. But when I asked them how they defined power, they used this whole idea of power as the ability to get things done. And when I asked them how then they got things done, these are the themes that kept coming around in their talk. They talked a lot more about turning things around than commanding change. They talked a lot more about growth over time than they talked about making snap decisions and judgments. So this became then an element of shared power.
What was that bottom thing, though? I never...
Oh, collaborative change?
Oh, okay.
Well, the idea that change, if it was going to be effective at all, was going to have to be done with others. It's kind of what you were saying about shared power, about building a vision on people's ideas of shared understanding. What the principals would be to talk with parents about what needed to be done in terms of what the parents wanted. They would, the principal would say things like, I think that it's important that we consider a way of changing our curriculum to meet the needs of X, Y, or Z. Come back to me with an idea of how you might like to do that. So that the teachers were given a lot of options and could create out of their understanding of the needs of their kids in their classroom a new curricular device or a new curricular idea, whatever. And so that collaborative, she would offer her services to help them in the process, urge them to work together with others. And that kind of change over time happened collaboratively. One principal explained that she had wanted to get the portables in the schoolyard painted. They were in such desperate need of painting. And the district did not want to paint them because they didn't have the money. And she had begged for 2 or 3 years to get the job done. It didn't get it done. So finally she got the parents to raise the money and paint the portables themselves. Looked beautiful, absolutely beautiful, and the district was furious because the parents were not union members. And yet the change happened because there was a willingness on the part of that team in the community to get a change to happen. They also went on to push for the possibility of those kinds of things happening when district money was not available. So it wasn't just a one-time thing, but it was a matter of getting district policy to balance the legitimate needs of a painting union and the legitimate needs of portables that were cracking and peeling.
Portables that were never temporary.
That were temporary, that were never supposed to be permanent.
Ended up
being permanent. Other comments or questions that you have about this concept of shared power?
I have a scenario to write by.
Oh, great.
I came here with an agenda, I have to confess.
Oh, well, that's fine.
I'm a new college registrar.
Oh.
And I find myself in a position of having power.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it's quite unwelcome power. And
uh-huh. Having to make choices.
It's gatekeeper power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's been interesting to listen to what you've shown up here on the board because I've tried some of that stuff.
Uh-huh.
There's things like deadlines for students to withdraw from classes.
Right.
Like that. And I've gone to the faculty members and to the deans above me and things like that and kind of said, well, who are we? Are we a customer service organization? Or are we hardcore policy people?
Right.
And they come back with, we want you to keep that policy in line.
Uh-huh.
We want you to be the gatekeeper. I'm like, I don't want to be that. I would much rather there be a sense of mutuality, that we're all kind of singing the same tune together to help students through this educational process and teach them some responsibility about how they handle their courses. And
right,
like
exactly. Uh-huh.
And I've gone to 3 different groups now and said that, who are we?
Uh-huh.
And gotten back from all 3 that they want me to be the gatekeeper.
No kidding. Yeah. So,
well, they want you to take the rap.
There may be
that's what they want. They want you to be
there. May be some consequences if you don't do this kind of deadline. In other words, supposing you let one kid stay in 3 class sessions, and another one stay in 8 class sessions. What, I don't think that's the problem. You have to do that a little bit lockstep. You have to have, or maybe you don't. Maybe there is no reason why you have to have a limit.
Yeah.
Maybe,
well, essentially it's a faculty policy.
Yeah, right.
That I administer.
But isn't there a point at which you have to make out the bill, or you have to define the number in class? Maybe there isn't. Maybe there isn't a reason to keep.
And this is a college level course.
Yes,
a college level. Yeah.
Schools really vary on that philosophy.
Right, they really do. They really, and there are places where there is less pressure put on daily attendance and more pressure put on the ultimate exam or the ultimate paper that is being done. It goes back, though, to the question of who are we and what is our purpose. Have you talked with faculty group? Are those the 3
groups? I've talked to one group that makes these policy recommendations to the Senate, and they together pass these policies. It's called the Academic Standards Committee.
Uh-huh. And that's made up of faculty.
Of faculty. Uh-huh. I've talked to them.
Yeah, but
and
academic,
they were like, well, this is our policy. We want to keep it this way.
Uh-huh.
We want you to, you know. And it's funny because the exceptions, lots of times, are coming from faculty members themselves, coming in and pressuring us to
make a leeway,
an
exception.
Yeah, and that it's really a bind sometimes. Yeah.
And you're in a position where it's difficult to re-engage the whole faculty with the Academic Senate in
yeah,
a discussion.
Yeah, it's too big. Yes.
But it may,
to do that easily.
Yeah.
It may be take time to make changes of the policy. I think that's what's involved here, is that in this kind of a collaborative situation, you may not accomplish any change this year, but it may come as you talk about it and explore it a little further and begin to raise questions about why do we have this policy?
Right.
I mean, you really raise questions about why is it? Is there some real value to it?
Right. You talked about dropping a class.
Oh, that's just one example.
Right. But with dropping, then that means this person might take another class. So therefore, how many class sessions would they miss before they would be allowed into another class and get credit? Could they, 4 or 5? Is that tied together? And then you mentioned that this was the which policy committee?
It was
academic standards.
Academic standards. So the only way I can make a standard out of when you drop a class is what happens next.
We're talking about drops way late in the term.
Yeah.
Aren't you more raising questions about how can you begin to get people to collaborate with you and rather than talking about the minutiae here, about how can you begin to, instead of just being a pyramid kind of a, where you're stuck in the middle ground.
Implementing a policy
which you
don't agree with.
Well,
totally, maybe.
How can we be more customer service oriented?
Right.
They are our customers, you know.
Right.
You know, you don't like to think of students that way, but essentially they are. And,
well, that's new.
And are we being punitive? Uh-huh. Why are we doing this? And it's an engineering environment where I work. Mm-hmm.
Oh my.
Uh-huh. You know, rules, regulations.
Right.
Yeah, the mindset.
You get the picture.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm like, well, who are we? Is this really the way we want to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like a lonely voice in the wilderness. You know?
these faculty are unclear on the concept that without the students, they wouldn't be there.
No, they're not that stupid.
Well,
right.
But they may not get the gradation that's coming now as the cost becomes higher, that the pool of clients becomes smaller.
Oh, it's absolutely true right,
right.
now.
Okay.
But the other thing is that working in an environment of engineers, it's engineering and health fields, but mostly engineering. Mm-hmm. Many of these men are trained to be engineers, mm-hmm. not to in these various mm-hmm. alternative ways of communicating.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, they can't communicate in the old ways, much less in the new way.
Yeah. Well, and it does present then a major problem. What I'm going to do is cut off the tape now. We can continue talking as long as we can, but our hour is up, and I'm sure the tape is running out. And I wanted to just quickly, at the end of the tape, mention briefly that the quality of collaboration is shaped by, in many ways, I believe, by our ability to share power. And I do hope that the kinds of models here at Holden...